Welcome to the CCYSC Awaaz podcast series. I'm Dr. Divya Kannan, Assistant Professor of History at Shivnada University and a co-convener of the CCYSC. Today, I'm delighted to have with us Dr. Heidi Morrison, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin. Heidi's work has traversed the region of Egypt, and her current work looks at childhood in the conflict zone of Palestine. Welcome to the podcast, Heidi.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to begin by asking, what led you to choose this particular subfield in history? I ask this because I happen to read on your official profile that as a high school student, you visited Egypt. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. Yes, when I was a teenager, an adolescent in high school, I found out about a program that brought high school students to the Middle East for a summer. And the program was interestingly founded and run by a lady named Ann Kerr. Her husband, she's an American, and her husband, Malcolm Kerr, was president of the American University of Beirut during the Civil War in the 1980s. And he was assassinated in his office by some Islamic extremists. He was seen as a symbol of American despotism. The wife, Anne, was left a widow, and she was left with four kids. And she was left with an awareness that the Middle East was much more than a place of terrorists, and that the war was that was going on was largely a product of a lot of misunderstandings. So she started a program to bring American students to the Middle East. She turned her experience from something bitter into something constructive, and the family actually subsequently went on and filed a lawsuit against this organization and decided to follow the rule of law in pursuing justice as a statement against the typical American response to terrorism, which is to respond with violence. So anyway, I spent the summer with her in Egypt, and it was a very transformative experience, as you can imagine, to be with somebody who was this immersed in the region and this sensitive. And it planted a seed in the region. And when I came back, I had to share my experience as part of the program, because it was a funded program. So I shared my experience to try to improve U.S.-Arab relations in the U.S. I shared my experience in schools and libraries, etc. Then I went on to college at UC Berkeley, and I was studying French, and I was continually drawn towards North Africa and the Francophone region. And I was about to go on to graduate school in that, but decided that I really wanted to look at the Middle East and North Africa, not from a French literature perspective, but from a Middle East perspective, in a less colonial approach, so to speak. So I started learning Arabic and learning about the history and context of the Middle East itself, as opposed to just the colonial presence in the Middle East. So I went on to do my master's and my PhD in the history of the modern Middle East. And all the while, you know, the seed that was planted from that early experience was one of trying to understand issues of justice and cross-cultural understandings. So I was drawn towards vulnerable actors. And the most vulnerable actors I could see in history were children, and they were very much not represented in the narrative of Middle East history as much as I saw that they were represented in Western accounts of history.
This is really fascinating, Heidi. And I'm really excited to know that you have been able to follow this passion of yours since high school. I would like to ask you now, what is the current state of the field of history of childhood and youth in the Middle East? Or in other words, according to you, what are the recent trends and debates in scholarship and otherwise in the Middle East on the question of childhood and youth?
So, first of all, I mean, we have to ask, what is the history of childhood and youth? And essentially, I define it as what people thought about children and how they represented children, and most importantly, how children themselves experienced the past. And also another component of the history of childhood is how that past informs us today. So in order to understand the evolution of the field of history of childhood, as I've articulated it in the Middle East, I think I always want to step back and give a perspective of the larger field of the history of childhood in the West, because in tracing the evolution of the history of childhood in the West, it helps contextualize where the history of childhood in the Middle East emerged on the scene, like how it emerged on the scene. So, I mean, I'm not sure how much your listeners are aware, but so I'll try to just be brief with this overview, but the general history in studying the history of childhood over the last few decades has sort of gone hand in hand with changing societal attitudes about power and about vulnerable groups. And as these attitudes have changed, so have ideas about children, and so have historians' interest in writing about them about the past. So the history of childhood is as much about the present moment as it is about the past. And sort of the seeds of this field in a very broad perspective started in the 60s and 70s when historians discovered, quote, I put that in quotes, that children have a history, that they have voices, that they have actions in the past, that they matter, they have a narrative of their own. And this was part of a larger sort of bottom-up move towards history of social, doing social history. And feminism, too, was ushering in an interest in categories that were largely, categories in history that were largely left out. And at looking at actors that had were taking, usually were given marginal place in society. So there was this gradual shifting of the views, and everyone knows about Philippe Ariès as the first historian of childhood, but his ideas were later subsequently proved not accurate. He said that in the medieval times there was no concept of childhood, because when he looked at it, he said, well, in the medieval times it doesn't look like childhood today, so they didn't have childhood. So these early attempts at history in the 60s and 70s, they were motivated from sort of like a bottom-up approach to history, but they were very they were very ethnocentric in a way. They didn't contextualize childhood in its time and place. And they had a very looking at adult attitudes towards children, not really trying to place children at the center of the narrative. And sort of looking at the history of child as one of progress over time. But then this is where the big shift in the history of childhood starts to happen that ushers in the history of childhood in the Middle East and other regions of the world. With the rise of postmodernism, there was this idea that there is no absolute truth, that everything is, you know, in relationship to one another. So if we start viewing social phenomena in a matrix of domination, then this led scholars to start thinking, well, then your experience in the past is conditioned by your race, your class, your gender, and by your age. So there can't just be like one way of being a child in the past. So then historians started to think, well, and starting to write about diversity of childhoods in the West, you start to see books on like immigrant working class children in American history, or girls and how their lives are different than just the generic childhood. And so there was also this contemporaneous jump from exploring the diversity of childhoods in the West to exploring the diversity of childhoods in the world. And so if there's more than one childhood in the West, then there must be the case for the world. And the history of childhood in the Middle East sort of grew out of this need to provide more narratives from different regions. And non-Western regional specialists, like in the Middle East, began creating their own histories of childhood. You know, they themselves, you know, are not to blame for not having had accounts before, but they were largely historians of the Middle East were preoccupied with other things before children. They were also sort of restricted in their ways of thinking because they were concerned. There was so ingrained this idea that the history of childhood was that which was the modern way of that it evolved in the West. You know, you had to go through this idea that children were innocent and then they got legal protections and school protections. And anything that diverged from it that didn't look just like that, you know, people often thought, well, then that's not the history of childhood. We don't have a history of childhood. But when people were opening up to the idea that there are many different kinds of childhood, then it started to leave space for historians in the Middle East to also ask about their own region. And also, a lot of historians had been blocked by a lot of pre-existing stereotypes that children in other parts of the world are just associated with dire children rights issues, that they didn't actually have a rich and deep history. Oh, children in Africa, oh, they're just, you know, AIDS or orphans or child soldiers. But this transformation in thinking that they could actually have a history too, and it's deep and meaningful. So some of the first historians to start writing the history of childhood in the Middle East were like in the 90s, and they began with an approach that was more like a little bit like Philippe Arias, like just sort of rescuing children and then inserting them into the narrative. But they gradually started to use the category of childhood and youth to engage with larger historical questions and to problematize the categories itself. So then you start to get works on children that are trying to be in dialogue with current issues in the history of childhood, or in the history of the Middle East, like issues of modernization, colonization, political activism. And children then become a launching point for discussions about larger issues in the Middle East, as well as a launching point for a dialogue with historians in other parts of the world about their histories of childhood. And that's sort of where we're at now. And we're still a growing field, but it's definitely growing.
Thank you for that, Heidi, because a lot of what you said resonates heavily with young scholars in South Asia, particularly many of us who have joined the field in the last few years. And we have also been grappling with this entire debate of childhood agency. The whole point about should we be pinpointing agency on children and their actions? Should they be bracketed as either victims or as resistors of certain agendas? And then generally the whole debate, as you know, about reconceptualizing agency itself. So a lot of what you have said, I feel, puts the field into perspective and also brings to light the question that many of us across geographical scales are actually invested in similar concerns of historical scholarship. I'm also interested to find out from you, is the subject of history of childhood and youth in the Middle East in dialogue with other subdisciplines? For instance, histories of medicine or histories of sexuality or even histories, military histories. Are scholars working on the Middle East having those kind of conversations? And also, very often the Muslim child tends to be vilified in media representations. As you know, a lot of what we know about children and youth in the Middle East come from Western media, and there is a tendency to reduce them either very simplistically or in very pejorative terms in visual representations. So how do you tackle this question of diversity alongside the question of having an intradisciplinary dialogue, if one may say so?
So the debates, so it seems you're asking two questions. One was about the diversities of childhood within the Middle East, and then the other was about how the field of Middle East history of children is dialoguing with other disciplines and in the humanities. So I guess I can start with the second one. The field is not, the field is relatively new, so there's not like a very well-developed conversation across the disciplines with history of childhood and, the sociology of childhood or anthropology of childhood in the Middle East. But it could be, argued that children and youth in the Middle East are very much leading the way and forcing historians to start dialoguing across disciplines. And by this, I mean that the impact of the Arab uprising since about 2010 has really made scholars in all different disciplines of the Middle East wake up more to children and youth and look at, to pay attention more to children and youth and their needs and histories, because You know, as Paul LaFasse has written, children are an emotionally resonant site with very symbolic power for society. And the children themselves are letting us, children and youth themselves are letting us know today that they want to be heard. And that's forcing scholars in all different disciplines to as well start listening and reading and researching about them. So in terms of also the when the Arab revolts or when the Arab Spring began in 2010, a lot of people were reporting that it was just sort of like a new phenomena that the youth were mobilizing. But historians of the region know that, you know, youth movements go back a long ways, and that we can't just explain modern events through the modern moment. So, you know, this has forced as well a dialogue between historians and political scientists and economists and anthropologists and sociologists to think about, well, what is the historical context that got us to this moment? So in a sense, that's an opening as well for interdisciplinary discussion. And as well, there's it's been, the Arab Spring has also been an awakening for historians to not just, you know, look in sort of a institutional approach to what would have been the reforms and how have childhood changed, like with educational reforms, but what actually are, we need to actually unpack the experience of being a child. And so we need to look, borrow from methods from sociology, you know, about relations and people not living alone, and looking at issues relevant as well to anthropology about how the collective group seeks to handle difficulties and forms of authority. So the history of childhood has also been awakening to these, the need to borrow on other methodologies to get a more complete picture of children and youth. And another way that there's been sort of a dialogue is that across the fields is that there's been a push, I think, toward the Middle East to embrace more forms of popular culture and find more creative ways beyond the written text as primary sources. And so we're all, in a sense, looking for a range of media and diverse forms to capture the human experience. Also, like in terms of this dialogue across disciplines, you know, like in a lot of developing countries, the statistics about regarding conditions of children, you know, are pretty staggering and not great in many parts of the Middle East. So a lot of questions are arising among sociologists, politicians, like why are these implementation of international treaties for children's rights not working in countries, some countries in the Middle East? And this has also forced a dialogue between these more contemporary scholars and historians to say, okay, well, if this was supposed to be the quote-unquote century of the child, why hasn't it not been this case in the Middle East? And people are realizing, well, it's not just these modern-day institutional or economic obstacles or war that's causing this condition, but we have to look at the historical past and from where this modern experience emerged. And a few things that, you know, we're starting to see is that there's been a process of what Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian calls unchilding. It's the use of children to advance political interests she writes specifically about it in the context of Palestine, but it can be applied to many different regions. And so the trying to look at the structural ways that childhood has been sort of like de-developed over the last century has brought anthropologists and sociologists in communication with historians. And then also, I mean, I think you asked something about gender. There's this historiographical tendency to lump women, mothers, and offspring together, like just women and children. They all just go in one word together. And that really obfuscates this specificity of women's experience and children's experiences. So there's a dialogue between children and women's studies to sort of differentiate those experiences that there are age also acts on gender. Gender acts on age. And the field needs to be imagined as, you know, both separate. The field of gender studies and children's studies both, you know, have cross paths and have their own histories. And I personally am interested in doing more interdisciplinary work that is not between social sciences and humanities, but more between the history of childhood and the medical sciences, the medical fields. So I'm currently when I finish my Palestine book, I'm starting a new project on, it's called When, you know, Fact Meets Experience. And all the and it's sort of looking at what are the medical numbers and statistics about children, how do they hold up over the last century when we compare that to the historical experience of living as a child. So trying to put two otherwise fields that are not in communication and dialogue. And I've begun working with a pediatrician who is also interested and wants to sort of find common ground if possible. I've had to sort of change my language a bit. I use the word problematize in discussions with him, and he said, well, you know, in the medical field, we don't use the word problematize. We have, you know, it either is something or it isn't. You know, what we're talking about and what we're thinking about in terms of this cross-disciplinary with the sciences is, you know, all the medical numbers before the Industrial Revolution show that there wasn't very much difference between children, children's experiences around the world, but the inequalities began to arise with the Industrial Revolution. And then the numbers, if you look at the statistics, like the numbers show that things are starting to even out since in the last 50 years. A lot of people are saying things are getting so much better for children, and they say that, for example, infant mortality rates going down, vaccination rates are going up, more and more girls are being educated. So it looks really rosy, like from a medical numbers and a sort of a statistical perspective. But that's where I want to, you know, bring this into dialogue with history, because, you know, I know from the history of the last 50 years that things have not necessarily gotten better for children in the Middle East. And so how do we, what do we make of these, you know, when these facts actually encounter the experience of being a child, and how do we reconcile these two different disciplines trying to talk about children at the same time?
I'm very taken in by what you mentioned is the debate between fact and fiction, Heidi. I find that really fascinating. And a lot of work on children and childhood have been in relation to the question of biopolitics itself, especially historians of sexuality and medicine in particular, have been speaking about children, children's bodies, sexuality, in close association with ideas of nation building, you know, conquest, gender domains, you know, so on and so forth. And in your own work on Egypt, which I must admit I thoroughly enjoyed reading, has been the question of how are these processes of modernity being negotiated by children, be it, again, in process of nation building or the rise of the middle class or the production of children's literature. Do you think these processes are very different when you study a region like Palestine, or do you see any point of convergence?
So the purpose of my book on Egypt was twofold. One, I wanted to add in historical narrative from a non-Western region to the otherwise Western-dominated narratives on childhood. And then the second purpose was as any history of childhood for any region should be doing, add some useful insights to the historical processes and transformations in the world or in the region under study, in this case, Egypt. So in order to try to achieve these two goals, my book looked at late 19th and early 20th century Egyptian experiences and representations of childhood by using otherwise unexplored sources like children's literature, children's press, also some more familiar Arabic sources like the writings of autobiographies and the writings of Egyptian intellectuals that had been looked at, but never through the microscope or lens of what they said about children. So these sources sort of indicate the ways that the literate class were thinking about children. So in terms of, you know, what the narrative, my book uncovered, that the history of childhood in Egypt adds to our understanding of the history of childhood in general, is that many aspects of the Western model of childhood at the beginning of the 20th century, the main aspects of it that we know are that, okay, children began to be seen as innocent, needed protection from the adult world, needed to be in age-graded schools, they're the future nation. And that's sort of the mainstream narrative about how childhood, the modern model of childhood has evolved. And the narrative says, okay, well, that evolved in Europe, and then it was exported and copied around the world as part of the process of the world modernizing. But what we see in Egypt is that Egyptians did, the nationalist reformers, intellectuals, they encountered these ideas from the West in their travels, in their studies with Egypt through colonization, and they were attracted and interested in them. But the book doesn't stop, the story doesn't end there. They didn't just copy and paste to the Middle East. They created a new and changing concept of childhood as well, but maintaining their own unique qualities. And the origins, well, a lot of people say the origins of the Western model of childhood is in the Enlightenment, Romanticism, and industrialization. A lot of the origins of the kind of childhood we get today in Egypt, even if it does very much resemble that in the West in some senses, a lot of the origins was not in, the Enlightenment or Romanticism, but was in resistance to imperialism and wanting to form a new generation of Egyptians that were stronger and able to throw off their colonizers. And this often translated into these Egyptian intellectuals and reformers referring not to like Enlightenment literature or Romanticism literature is about innocence of the child, but instead referring to their own heritage to shape ideas about childhood. So there's a body of literature in Arabic called Adab literature, which dates the medieval period. And it's a large body of literary sources that include medical and legal writings. And it's a corpus also of instructions on how to raise a child to have the right morals and values. So these scholars in the 20th century would tap back into those sources to shape what they wanted to see evolve in childhood. And also, they would also tap into some of their own Islamic past. For example, one of the reformers said that the idea of the Boy Scouts is actually something that's very much imbued with the spirit of Islam. And the Prophet himself is the ultimate example of a Boy Scout. These nationalist elites that were trying to change the concept of childhood, you know, they did it with their own twist. It wasn't just a copy and paste. They used Egyptian heritage dating from pharaonic times to Islamic, to Mediterranean era. And I'm not the only one to show this. Like, there's also scholars looking at the Ottoman Empire who said that, yes, Western educational systems were not just imported, you know, copy and paste, but they were put into the appropriate context of the Islamic Ottoman era. Same with Lebanon, that they didn't just, resist French colonial project in Lebanon just based on, Western ideas of childhood, but they were integrating the idea that their children were daughters and sons of Arab and Lebanese civilization. And so the examples go on and on. And I imagine, and I know, this same thing plays out around the world. And the book also wanted to contribute to, as I think any history of childhood should do, contribute to the understandings of the historical processes. I mean, we're not just talking about children for children's sake, is like children can also be another actor, another window into bigger questions that everyone's already thinking about. One of them is that the process of how do you make this question, historians are always talking about, how do you make the modern nation? And usually people say, well, at first it was just like, oh, the colonizers threw off the colonizers. But then people started to get some more nuances. Historians said, well, no, there's also the control of population, like peasants were used to build a new nation, mothers as future citizens, men, masculinity, the poor. So my book is saying, okay, well, that's great. All those have, but what about also the category of age? You know, modernity has been a function of how we think about age as well. And it's an integral process to building the nation. This translated into big changes in children's lives. But that sort of gets me to another question you asked earlier about diversity of childhoods, because these processes of modernization, you know, are not even, it's not a smooth process. It didn't just happen evenly throughout the Middle East. We see that there were lots of mixed like emotions that went along with it. Children's emotions played a role in a lot of the autobiographies I've read about Egypt. We see, for example, maybe one girl, she recalls that she was trying to use a knife and fork at school in the cafeteria. And then the school inspector told her, like, you have to eat separately from other students until you learn the modern ways of eating. And these feelings of humiliation and fear, you know, went into building the modern nation among children. It wasn't just a smooth process. And their experiences too were very different. The experiences of girls was not the same as boys. And oftentimes, I think that, like, how does all this connect to modern day? Well, the emergence of this modern quote unquote concept of childhood that emerged in the early 20th century, it emerged in a very like racialized and gentrified and gendered structures that were part of the larger process of modernization. So, like, the changing conceptions of childhood, when we think that came to Egypt, that maybe there were more kids going to school, more time of an innocence, less kids working the field, that wasn't evenly spread across the country. There was also the pattern was set for a lot of inequality that would shape and continue to haunt Egypt and parts of the Middle East till today. These new opportunities that did emerge in the early 20th century were more for upper-class children. Most children didn't see any changes at all, or they made some sort of hybrid, maybe identity. So
how does all this play out in a conflict zone? Do we see disjunctures, especially within the region of Middle East, given that children in Palestine are active participants in contemporary processes? As well as given their long-standing histories of violence and trauma, how do you think this concept of modernity and childhood and youth participation in politics intersect when you study a region such as this? Or what I'm more keen to know is, what are the methodological challenges in studying such regions?
So when I was completing my first book on how this modern concept of childhood came to Egypt in the early 20th century, I started asking myself, okay, well, I've looked at a place in the Middle East where this modern model, and I put modern in parentheses or in quotes, where it arrived, but what about in places in the Middle East where it has not arrived or it's been severely thrown off course? And so I began to look at Palestine, a region where in many cases, you could say that the quote-unquote modern model of childhood has not arrived or has been de-developed, or children have been unchilded due largely to violence. So then I started to look at children, the situation of children in Palestine, a place where I thought, well, you know, the concept of childhood has, and the experience of childhood has been severely interrupted. And I selected a time period, the Second Intifada, a period of intensified violence between 2000 and 2006, to see what was it like to be a child during that time. And I thought, you know, so there's so many important poster children of war that's emerged over the last century, from Holocaust victim Anne Frank to child soldier Ismail Bey. And the world condemns this violence near universally and says that this toxic stress is very bad and harmful to children, especially, you know, because they're in their developmental years, and it causes long-term physical and mental damage. And it can even include like epigenetic changes, and it can damage the child when they're in the womb. So what then about these children entrenched in armed conflict, like the Palestinian children, whose pain and suffering rarely are making the headlines or is not understood, they're being are not understood as a consequence of the Zionist settler colonial project, which is in the process of unchilding. So I started to think about how is trauma embedded in Palestinian history and memory and in the experience of being a child and growing up, and how do people live with that trauma and survive? And I wanted to know more about trauma than just like clinical symptoms, like, okay, the kids, how many kids had nightmares? How many kids wet their bed, you know, during this period of violence? But instead, like, how does the trauma live with them, live in their memory? So I was started doing oral histories with a select group of children in Palestine. And again, the diversity there is itself, you know, enormous. I have, you know, some children, or one person who, well, now they're a young adult, but who was, you know, who had very weak in reading and writing, another who's gone off to an elite college in the United States. You have Christians, you have Muslims. So even within in Palestine, I try to get a representative body. You know, in talking to them and trying to construct a narrative, I mean, I found that in them trying to construct a narrative about their suffering, that itself is a major part of healing, and that there's a dignity in having a story, especially for people that have been unchilded and their story has been so misunderstood. And so that project looks at the power of narration in healing in war for children, and also looks at how war acts along very hegemonic lines. The situation worsens based on your race, class, and gender a lot of times, and war really preys on the most vulnerable children within a society. And another part of that project, which I think it's to your other question about emotions and power, is that the project also puts into question the idea of agency. That's a word that's thrown around a lot these days in childhood studies, but there's a growing body of people who are questioning, you know, just how useful that word is as a concept. When the concept first came about in the 60s and 70s, agency, it was really, you know, intended to give voice to marginalized and neglected people, and to complicate, you know, top-down structural views of power that instead ordinary people on the ground can act up, or can act, react, and resist. And so, but people have began to ask questions like, okay, the concept of agency itself is, maybe we need to re-engage with its purpose, because it sort of has this narrow lens that the human being must act through exercising free will, and that autonomous action is, you know, the only way to have quote unquote agency. But, you know, when you look at children, that they, we can't just assume that that's the only way children have agency. It's a very sort of upper class Western model of agency, because in some societies, children earn their power and elevate their social position through actually being useful and mastering assigned responsibilities, so not resisting. So that in itself is a form of agency. And so sometimes if we just have this Western motion of agency as the autonomous individual, that can come at the price of the children themselves. And so I'm trying to look at how this plays out in Palestine as well. And there's also some other problems for children, in that, you know, we try to like go into, we're going to liberate the child, we're going to liberate the child and give them their voice. And that in itself is very sort of an entitled way of looking at the past. And this sort of has really begun to shape, you know, agendas, careers, and granting institutions. If you can go in and you can liberate and find me the voice of the child, that's become very institutionalized. And I think we need to move away from that. And that's what I'm trying to avoid, this, what Mona Gleason calls this agency trap. And that means going beyond looking at binaries of, you know, the adult versus the child, strong versus the weak, powerful versus powerlessness. And instead try to complicate it and ask, what I'm trying to do is ask more questions about, like, why did children act the way they did? And that draws us into their emotional world. What was the thinking of the child? What was pushing them to do things? What were the tensions they were feeling? And so not trying to, you know, come up with some answer that yes, that child had agency or no, but instead trying to look at the emotional world of the child.
Thanks, Heidi. So I just wanted to move towards the final set of questions. What you said about Mona Gleason's agency trap is very relevant for many of us in South Asia as well. There has been an obsessive, I would say, a kind of preoccupation with simply recovering children's voices, particularly in the archives, something that happened even to feminist histories in the early days, where you would literally insert women's voices back into historical accounts. And we unfortunately see that happening also in academic institutions. The kind of nuanced approach that you are talking about is still amiss, at least in the academic spaces in South Asia. So it's very interesting to hear you talk about moving away from these binaries, looking at the spectrum of both emotional formations as well as children's actions and reactions, sometimes passive, sometimes active. I was just wondering, as a historian of childhood and Middle East, how have you been engaging with this larger debate between, for a lack of a better word, the global South and the global North? For instance, a lot of inequalities in knowledge production. I was wondering whether historians in the Middle East have been debating this for long. Are there any new ways of looking at questions?
I think that this discussion of agency that you're asking about, in terms of among more scholars in the Middle East, is a very new topic and one that hasn't been explored much at all. There's still, it's still seen as like a very safe argument to say, and then they were resilient and had agency. But there are increasingly scholars who are putting into question the idea of resiliency, maybe more than agency. Resiliency is this idea that you will always sort of, that the children can rebound, they're so strong, and they come back and they fight to keep their childhood. And while very much that may very much happen, it also sort of simplifies children's experiences, and it also sort of obfuscates the structural roles of oppression that are creating the problems for children. So we see oftentimes that we want to say, oh, well, children are resilient to trauma in the Middle East, but that pathologizes trauma and makes it seem like it's just a medical condition, and children, you know, if they wet their bed, then we can just stop them from wetting their bed, and we can just maybe give them some sort of therapy and they can get better. But really, you know, that sort of idea of rebounding from trauma, being resilient, obfuscates that you can't end the trauma. You can't with, you know, a pill or with a psychotherapy, that there are these huge structures of unchilding, of violence, of against the child that are happening. So I think that there is an openness to problematizing agency, but it's more coming in the form of how people are looking at resiliency of children in situations of violence. But I think that there's a lot of room still to do work on agency. I mean, the way that we have conceived it now too, it sort of leaves intact adult privilege, that if the child doesn't act like an adult, then the child doesn't have agency. But there's so many ways beyond acting like an adult that can bring the child action and power. So recognizing, you know, children's voice is important, but it also has its limitations. If we don't if we just look at it like this inevitable move towards maturity, like, oh, the child had agency because he's acting more and more mature and rational and independent.
Thanks, Heidi. I wanted to just ask you, I'm really interested to know about the approach of oral history to studying histories of childhood. You mentioned that with a select group of children, you were able to do that in Palestine. What are the methodological challenges of having oral history research with children?
Oral history is, you know, when I first started doing oral history, I went to an oral history training summer institute at Columbia, and I got my 2 weeks of training, and then I was off to the West Bank to start my oral history project. And so much of what I learned in the seminar was important, but some of it also didn't sort of work in the context that I was working in. Things that I wasn't prepared for were like my reception as an American, who is often considered, you know, somebody that's the source of the problem in the region, and also showing up with like forms to fill out, like sign this form, you have to have a legal release and this and that. Now that's very important. You know, there's protocols and of working with human subjects that are very important. But it's not as black and white as you just show up, you know, as this white American in somebody's house and have them sign a form. I mean, they're scared. Like, what are you having me sign? Like, who are you? Are you a spy? What are you going to do with this interview? What? I mean, it's in English. I don't even understand this. I mean, if you translate it, then it's confusing. So some of the problems with doing oral history was trying to be flexible to the context in which I was researching in. But some of the beauties of doing oral history is that you could really get at the experience of being, of living. And it's, you know, we hear about violence from the perspective of politicians, from, you know, media, but what about the children on the playground? Like their voice, how do you get at that? That's not captured in your average like political speech. But you can get at it through oral history because you can talk to the people and let them create their own historical archive through oral history. And yes, you have to take into consideration problems of memory and the dynamics of power. You know, it's not just, you know, do you take it at face value, whatever the person said is what happened. But it is a rich resource to get into sort of the life of those whose experiences are not normally captured in the mainstream narrative. And I did a sort of a life story or life history approach where I went back several times to the same people over the course of about 8 years, of about 10 young adults that I've been talking to over 8 years, because rich communication takes time to evolve. You can't just come in, sit down, do an interview, and great, I figured you out. But you need to keep going back, seeing how the person changes, seeing how they answer questions differently in different times and contexts. And even just doing also interviews with their larger community, getting to know their parents, doing oral histories with their parents or their siblings, to really take a more well-rounded approach. So oral history is a very like rich source, and particularly in a place like Palestine, where the place, you know, it's a place that wants to, that in many cases, is considered not to exist in the world. It's not a nation. It doesn't have its own, you know, even flag hanging in the UN. So they don't have this quote unquote national archive in a very formal sense of the word. So oral history is a way to create that history of a people whose history has tried to be erased.
Yes, one can only imagine the kind of impact that violence has had or continues to have on generations of children in the Palestine region. Finally, I would like to ask you, Heidi, where do you locate children and youth in the Middle East in the contemporary moment? As in, with climate change protests raging across the world, and of course, as we speak today, in the midst of a lockdown, the COVID pandemic, growing refugee crisis in parts of the world. Where would you, as a scholar of children and youth locate them in what can be called as the contemporary moment?
I mean, I may be biased because I'm a scholar of children and youth, but I locate children and youth in the Middle East in the front and center of the current situation in the world. They matter, not just because they are our future, but because they are human beings, and particularly human beings that need special protection because they are more vulnerable. And that is why you don't get the, that's why the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was not enough for children. Certain groups were more vulnerable and needed their own category of protection. And so children are one of those, and they are front and center of the ones who are suffering and needing protection during the pandemic, during the political crises, during the wars that are going on. They're leading the way, like through the Arab Spring. A lot of people think, oh, okay, the Arab Spring, the challenges, Arab Spring was because these young people are really upset. And the reasons they're upset are that there is, they're like oppressed by dictators. And then like it stops there. Or it might go to the next step that, oh, then the West better, you know, intervene and bring democracy. And then that will be the way that will liberate these young people. But it's much, much, much more complicated than that. There are despotic leaders. Yes, youth do want a functioning democracy. But they also want, they want freedom from a neoliberal world that is entrenching them in poverty and with the blind sort of under the guise of supposed to be bringing, lifting them up to higher levels. They want freedom from violence that is being held and conducted to secure Western hegemony in the region and control over oil resources. So they want much more than just liberation from their dictators. And this, they're not just a product of the modern social media. Some people say, oh, the Arab youth, the Arab Spring, oh, it's just because they had Twitter now that they could do that. I mean, people had ways of communicating even before that. It's a tool, it helps facilitate it, but it's not just a Twitter revolution. I mean, there's legitimate claims and problems and needs of the youth in the Middle East today that unfortunately are very much tied to our lives in the Middle East or in the West, and for which we play a large role in creating those problems with our international politics.
Thank you so much, Heidi, for your time. And it's been great talking to you today. And there's so much of insight in, you know, like you said, diverse childhood, but also for those of us in South Asia to start seriously engaging with scholarship in other parts of the world as well. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, it's important too for scholars, all of us, to engage in South Asia as well. So thank you so much for your time and for your interest and for your work with the critical childhood youth studies.
It was really wonderful talking to you, Heidi. And thank you so much for agreeing to be a part of this today.